Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for August 2010. This is issue number 329. Our address for the DX Audio Service is 706 McKenzie Drive, Lima, Ohio, 45805. Email address for general inquiries is fvobe, that's F-V-O-B-B-E, at realoldiesradio.com. And my phone number for short calls is 419-228-6223. For subscription questions, use sales, S-A-L-E-S, at nrcdxas.org. A yearly cassette subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S. Canadian members is $28. To subscribe or renew, make your check payable to the National Radio Club and send them to me at the address that I just mentioned. Or you can log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using PayPal. If you're on the internet, you can sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service in MP3 format. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with PayPal, but subscribe only if you're able to download and navigate a website without anyone's assistance. Well, let's swing it right over to Los Angeles, California. Here's Dave Alpert with a look at the AM Switch.
Welcome to the July 2012 edition of AM Switch, Volume 79, Issue 28, starting with call letter changes. 810 WEUS in Orlo Vista, Florida becomes WRSO. 820 WWAM in Jasper, Tennessee has changed calls to WTNW. 1170 KOWZ Waseca, Minnesota, up in the land of Durenberger, has become KRUE. 1180, the first step of returning things to the way they should be, is KOIL in Bellevue, Nebraska, becoming KZOT. But wait, there's more. 1190 WHYN in Humble, Tennessee, becomes WJPJ. The biggie of the week, 1290 KKAR in Omaha, Nebraska, returns to its legacy call of KOIL. Many of you will remember COIL from its days as a top 40 station. 1300 WAMF in Fulton, New York, becomes WOSW. The CP on 1350 in Agana, Guam, now has call letters, and the station will be KUSG. 1380 KSLG in St. Louis, Missouri, is now KXFN. 1470 KRBR in Estes Park, Colorado, becomes KDEB. 1480 WGUS Augusta, Georgia, has changed to WCHZ. And finally, 1600 WLUZ Bayamon, Puerto Rico, is WCMA now. Construction permits on the air, we have a few. 540 WRGC Silva, North Carolina, is now U1, 5 kilowatts day and 140 watts night, after changing from U2, 1,000 watts day and 250 watts at night on 680. 570 WFNL in Raleigh, North Carolina, is now U1, 1,000 watts day and 40 watts night after making a downgrade in their night power of 52 watts. 830 KOTC, now on the air from Memphis, Tennessee, with facilities of D1, 3,000 watts daytime, after moving from Kennett, Missouri, with D1, 10 kilowatts. We'll have more when we discuss applications in a moment. 1050 WFSC in Franklin, North Carolina, is on the air with U1, 5 kilowatts day, 153 watts night, from facilities of U1, 1,000 watts day, 153 watts night. 1050 WDVM in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, is on the air with U1, 860 watts day and 260 at night. They were U1, 1,000 watts day and 500 night. 1060 KFOI Sparks, Nevada, has just received their program test authority, which is FCC talk, for okay to begin broadcasting on a regular schedule for this new station. KFOI has been granted for U4, 10,000 watts day, 250 watts night, from two towers just to the southeast of Reno. Day and night patterns are identical, butterfly shape, going east and west, so DXers in the Midwest, as well as over in Sacramento, California, have a chance of hearing this new station. 1260 WI3XSO in Aguadilla, Puerto Rico, has received their okay to change to U4, 5,000 watts day and 4,800 watts night. They were U5, 2,500 watts day and 850 night. 1290 WWHM, Sumter, South Carolina, is now U1, 1,000 watts day and 12 watts at night. They were U2, 1,000 watts day and night. 1420 WCED in Dubois, Pennsylvania, is U1, 4,200 watts day, a mighty 5 watts at night. They made some adjustments from being U2, 5,000 watts day and 500 night. And 1550 WCLY, Raleigh, North Carolina, U1, 1,000 watts day, 8 watts night, after a big increase on their night power from 7 watts. Under actions, 680 CHFA in Edmonton, Alberta, has tendered a CP with the CRTC to replace CHFA with an FM station as CHFA FM 10 on 90.1 with 100 kilowatts horizontal at 124 meters. That CP has been granted, and once the new FM station signs on, CHFA 680 may remain on for up to 90 days. Then it's gone for good. 690 WIST in New Orleans, Louisiana, has their CP granted for U1, 9,100 watts day and 108 watts night from their old facility of U4, 10,000 watts day and 5,000 watts night. 730 WZGV, Cramerton, North Carolina, has their CP granted for U1, 10,000 watts day, 170 night. They were U1, 10,000 watts day and 190 at night. But the new night transmitter will move to tower number 3 of the WYFQ 930 Charlotte, North Carolina array, which is about 8 miles to the east-northeast of the day site and in the northwest suburbs of Charlotte. On 1330, WNIX, Greenville, Mississippi, is licensed for U2, 1,000 watts day and 500 watts night. WNIX has a construction permit for U1, 1,000 watts day and 55 watts night. This action has them filing for a special temporary authorization, or STA, for U1, 1,000 watts day and 125 watts night, while they dismantle two of their three towers in preparation for them to implement the construction permit. 1340 KRMD, Shreveport, Louisiana, is licensed for U1, a kilowatt day and night. KRMD is operating under an STA with U1, 370 watts day and night, as they conduct field measurements on their signal to establish ground conductivity in the vicinity of their transmitter site. 1400 WBIZ, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, licensed for U1, 1,000 watts day and night, but operating U1, 500 watts day and night, as in the wording of the application. An extreme wind event in the late afternoon of May 24th resulted in the toppling of the station's antenna tower. A horizontal wire antenna has been attached to a temporary 30-foot grounded support near the former tower location. The wire runs from there 160 feet in a north-northwest direction to another temporary support. It is excited at the end nearest the former tower by a coaxial feed line. End quote. The application states they would be using a power not to exceed 500 watts. 1420 WVJS, Owensboro, Kentucky, has had their CP granted for U1, 980 watts day and 20 watts night. Owensboro is about 60 miles west-southwest of Louisville and is formerly U4, 5,000 watts day and 1,000 watts night. 1470 WCLA, Claxton, Georgia, has had their CP granted for 1,000 watts day, 170 watts night, from their U1, 1,000 watts day, 260 watts night, by moving to the tower of WMCD 107.3, Claxton. The WMCD tower is almost double the height of WCLA's current facility, so they must reduce their night power to theoretically provide coverage to the same area. 1480 KAUS, Austin, Minnesota, is now licensed for U4, 1,000 watts day and night, but KAUS is operating under an STA with U1, 250 watts day and night during renovation of the licensed four-tower directional antenna system. 1530 WOBX, Wanchese, North Carolina, is licensed for D3, 1,000 watts daytime only, and operating D1 250 watts daytime only until repairs are made to their phasing unit. 1590 WCGO Evanston, Illinois has had their CP granted for U2 7200 watts day, 2000 watts night from a site located north of Chicago and east of Des Plaines. Their pattern shoots north-northwest over Lake Michigan, making it a hard station to log. Okay, so let's move on to applications now. Remember, we said we'd have more on 830 KOTC Memphis, Tennessee. This newly licensed station with facilities of D1 3,000 watts daytime has now applied for D1 8,000 watts day and critical hours. So don't be surprised to see a night application come our way too soon. On 1,000 kilohertz, KNWS Waterloo, Iowa has applied for their 1,000 watts of critical hour power authorization to be simply D1 1,000 watts daytime only. Now, amendments to applications. 590 WAFC, Clewiston, Florida, licensed for U1 930 watts day and 470 watts night. WAFC applied for U3 5,000 watts day and night, along with a change in the city of license to Cape Coral, Florida. This request only changes the application to read U4 in place of U3. U3 means unlimited time operation, directional pattern, all hours, using the same pattern. U4, on the other hand, means full-time operation with a different pattern, day and night. One of these days we should probably cover these designations, unless everybody already knows them. If you don't, let Fred know, and we'll do a special on a future issue. The application on 1030 in Melba, Idaho, for U2, 50,000 watts day and 1,000 watts night. This amendment requests U4, 500 watts day and night. Some change. And 1510 WQUL Woodruff, South Carolina is licensed for D1 1,000 watts daytime with critical hours power of 250 watts. WQUL applied for D1 930 watts daytime and critical hours power of 27 watts. This amendment requests D1 930 watts daytime and a change to 28 watts during critical hours. Considering consultants' pay and FCC filing fees, I hope the watt was well worth the work. Now, on to applications and construction permits dismissed. 620 WSNR, Jersey City, New Jersey, has an application for U4, 15,000 watts day and night, but this one was dismissed, and WSNR remains U4, 3,000 watts day and 7,600 watts night. 860 WDMG, Douglas, Georgia, has been licensed for U2, 5 kilowatts day and night. WDMG applied for U1, 5 kilowatts day and 29 watts at night. Then they applied for U1, 5,000 watts day and 30 watts at night. That later request has been dismissed, so they go back to 29 watts at night. Again, you have to wonder what 1 watt will do. 890 KQLX, Lisbon, North Dakota, had tendered an application for D1, 2,500 watts, daytime only, with critical hours power of 2,500 watts. That application was dismissed, so KQLX remains D1, 1,800 watts daytime until they refile for the 2,500 watts they ask to amend. Here in our news, returning to the airwaves, WNOV 860 Milwaukee, Wisconsin, with urban music. KSKE 1450 Buena Vista, Colorado, with surveillance, weather, and traffic. WRLV 1140 Sailorsville, Kentucky, with country as pure country for their slogan. Reported as silent. WHFB 1060, Benton Harbor, Michigan. WROP 1390, Belton, South Carolina. KENT 1400, Parowan, Utah. WJPI 1470, Plymouth, North Carolina. WJDJ 1490, Hartsville, South Carolina. WMJL 1500, Marion, Kentucky. And WTNI 1520, Brunswick, Maryland. Again. Fines. KBPO 1150, Port Neches, Texas, fined $15,000 for failure to make available a complete public inspection file And if that's not enough, another $25,000 for willful violation of the commission's rules involving provision of incorrect factual information of a material nature to the commission regarding their public inspection file without a reasonable basis for believing the information was correct and accurate. WCXI 1160 Fenton, Michigan fined $17,000 for public inspection file and tower fencing issues. WSNJ 1240 Bridgeton, New Jersey and WMVB-FM Millville, New Jersey fined $16,000 for public inspection file and other issues. WIPC 1280 Lake Wales, Florida, $3,500 fine for not switching to their night power and pattern in accordance with its license schedule. And WOAP 1080 Owosso, Michigan fined $4,000 for operating past their local sunset. In case you don't know, WOAP is a daytime-only station. Thanks to Tim Noonan, Dave Schmidt, Ernie Wesolowski, Upper Midwest Broadcasting and Radio World Online for their reports, and you, the membership. I'm Dave Alpert on the AM Switch. And just a reminder, if you hear a station coming back on, which is silent, or don't hear a station you should be hearing, drop us a call on the Musings line at 419-741-0205 and let us know. Your ears and observations are important to us. Also important to us, Mark Durenberger with a DX Audio Service band scan.
Thanks, Dave, and hello, everyone. As you listen to this month's DX Audio Service, you might be involved in the NRC convention in Bridgeport. Hope you were able to put it on your schedule. I only wish I could have attended to say howdy. There's been a lot going on here on the Norwegian Riviera, but I have been able to stick to one of my summer goals, and that's to build an informal knowledge base on radio noise that we'll be sharing with you soon in the form of some how-to ideas for better reception. Summer's usually a bad time for DX, isn't it? But it's a great time to be working on knocking down the electrical interference. Just taking a moment to look at the weather map as we record this, today is July 17th, I realize how fortunate we are here in Minnesota. Even though our temps have been playing footsie with 100 degrees, we've not had to deal with the flooding and the severe drought y'all are facing elsewhere. How strange the results from back-to-back El Niñas. Anyhow, we're broadcasting today from the chicken coop at our north-central Minnesota lake cabin, where we've thrown up a 50-foot pine tree vertical antenna. And in playing with various systems that match the antenna to the receiver, I've been able to get the radios sounding pretty good. One thing weather-wise that helps, usually, of course, summer reception is really beat up by atmospheric disturbances, but during this prolonged hot, humid spell, the natural interference has been minimal, a lot less lightning noise. Well, we'll put what we've learned this summer into a future column because we know how important this is. And not just to you folks, but to municipalities as well. For example, back to the Minneapolis studio for a moment as we listen to your fearless reporter recording a piece from the Green Bay, Wisconsin Gazette. Radio reception problems prompt call for study. Reports of problems with AM radio reception in parts of Green Bay neighborhoods have prompted a county lawmaker to call for a study of electromagnetic fields along University Avenue. Residents on parts of the city's east side this year have complained of radio reception difficulties, said Brad Hopp, a Brown County supervisor. He asked last week that the county conduct a study on whether excess electromagnetic radiation is causing problems, perhaps because of the amount of electrical transmission equipment in the area. This is more to satisfy my constituents' concerns, he said, but I have some concerns myself. Hopp, who is in his first term on the county board, said several residents in his district raised concerns during his campaign. Radiation is emitted by electronic devices where electricity flows, from video monitors to cell phones to power lines. A spokesman for Wisconsin Public Service Corp, responsible for the power lines, said a line that has broken insulation modulation equipment could affect reception of certain broadcast signals. Spokesman Kerry Spies said the company receives one or two calls a year about radiation interference. In such cases, he said, the company sends an employee to the area to check equipment and correct any problems. Thank you, Mark. Gee, he has a pleasant voice, doesn't he? But he sounds like he just got out of bed. Full disclosure, I had just gotten out of bed. So improving reception will be a significant part of future columns. We're also progressing with our State of the Station series. We had terrific response from the Los Angeles piece. Thank you in particular, Terry Livingston Hughes. It's fun to follow up some of these stories. Remember we told you about Sister Amy Semple McPherson and her four-square tabernacle station thumbing her nose at the feds? Well, here's a follow-up we just received that suggests that the original story may have been embellished a tad. For that story, we go back to the Minneapolis studio, where the guy now sounds wide awake. Y'all recall a few months back when we did the story on Los Angeles radio? We spent some time on Sister Amy Semple McPherson and her four-square gospel station. A lot of the information was obtained from Jim Hilliker's excellent work, which is posted on Jeff Miller's History of American Broadcasting website. We'll tell you about that in a moment, but we had this supplemental information we wanted to pass on. You'll recall that we were talking about Amy Semple McPherson and the Federal Radio Commission and the Secretary of Commerce, Herbert Hoover, and we said that she had sent an angry telegram about her station KFSG. Hoover, during those years, was sometimes called the Radio Czar because he was in charge of broadcasting between 1920 and 1926. Here is Hilliker's information, and we quote, "The supposed 1920s telegram reportedly contained the phrase, 'Please order your minions of Satan to leave my radio station alone.' For many years, I believed that this story was true, but now, after examining the facts closely, I think it's just another myth from radio's earliest years, not unlike the commonly heard statement that KDKA was the first radio station in the universe. Such a telegram likely was never sent by McPherson. Hoover's telling of the story is full of gaps. My research has found no mention of this incident in any newspapers or popular radio magazines of the 20s. Neither Hoover nor McPherson ever spoke or wrote about such an incident at the time. Hoover first told the story in a 1945 radio speech. He later wrote about it in Volume 2 of his memoirs in 1951. Hoover claimed that McPherson sent the alleged telegram after the Department of Commerce had warned her about her station, KFSG. Hoover said that KFSG had wandered all over the wave band, causing interference to other Los Angeles stations. Hoover added that warnings about KFSG sticking to its own frequency did no good, so the radio inspector sealed up her station, taking it off the air. Hoover never gave an exact date or year that this alleged incident took place. There are no reports of KFSG ever being taken off the air in the records of the radio service bulletins published by the Department of Commerce at the time. More than 50 books on radio history have repeated the McPherson-Hoover telegram story. Most claim the alleged incident took place in 1924 or 1925, but none give an exact date for the telegram. As far as KFSG causing interference to other stations, there's only one piece of evidence that shows that this part of the story is true. The District Radio Inspector for California, Colonel J.F. Dillon, sent two letters to Mrs. McPherson within 2 weeks after KFSG's first broadcast in February of 1924. Dillon said his office was receiving complaints about KFSG causing interference to reception of KHJ and KFI. Dillon believed the problem was not caused deliberately by KFSG's equipment, but the inferior, less selective radios made in 1924. KFSG was never closed down and taken off the air, as Hoover claimed, and KFSG's excellent engineer, Kenneth G. Ormiston, worked hard to help Los Angeles area radio fans who had interference problems. He also helped those who wanted to get better reception. Ormiston was technical editor of Radio Doings magazine and answered readers' questions about radio on KFWB each week in 1925. Ormiston also helped to get KFWB on the air that year, year, and in 1934 he was in charge of boosting the power of KNX to 50,000 watts. Notably, McPherson's son, Dr. Rolf K. McPherson, shed further doubt in a 1994 letter to me before his death. McPherson said, "This is one of the many rumors which have persisted through the years. Mother never attempted to defy the law, but always endeavored to comply with the rules. The statements you mention certainly were not typical of her way of doing things. I might explain that the equipment in those days was not always adequate, but the situations were cleared as quickly as they could be. It is difficult to prove a negative, but I believe interference was a common problem in early radio. I believe there are several gaps in Hoover's story about the alleged telegram. I believe my research suggests that the incident never took place, and that it is time to bury this story, or at least demand more evidence of its veracity. But you decide for yourself. I've posted my detailed essay about the myth on Jeff Miller's History of American Broadcasting website. It's http://jeff560.tripod.com/kfsg2.html. Since I started researching and writing about early Los Angeles radio, I've found there is little reliable information available, but plenty of inaccurate or false information. I try to set history straight in my articles on early radio. And that follow-up article was written by Jim Hilliker on KFSG, Sister Amy Semple McPherson, and Four Square Gospel Radio. So it appears some good stories never end. We've also had a lot of good input from you for our Cleveland and Atlanta reviews. So next time, we'll be reporting from Miami in response to Mike Lance's gentle nagging. I think you're aware that putting these reports together involves an incredible amount of footwork and fact-checking. So it's the sort of thing we can bring you only occasionally. But watch for the Miami State of the Station report coming soon over most of this same cassette. And speaking of cassettes, if you listened carefully to our July edition, you heard Fred talking about ways to protect your investment in the service. The last thing anyone wants to do is to raise the cost of subscriptions. So I think we're on to something here with the CD idea, and I urge you to respond immediately to Fred if you can't handle CDs. You don't need to respond if you can handle CDs. Just tell him if you can't. If we can get a go-ahead on the CD version of the DX Audio Service, we can get to work immediately, at least with some test versions for some of you. And, as Fred mentioned, this also opens the door to a possible 2-CD set, which would give us the ability to expand our broadcast day from 92 minutes to 2 hours and 30 minutes or more. So let's hear from you so we know this is the right way to go, okay? Now, where were we? Oh, the band scan. Back to the business at hand, we're putting the finishing touches on some scans from Florida. Last spring, we took the programmable radio and our mobile antenna to Fort Myers, where we parked just outside the Twins' spring baseball stadium, in what turned out to be a very quiet electrical environment. As a result, reception was terrific. We'll bring you that report either next month or in October. We also have recordings made in the Florida Panhandle, and we'll share those with you as well. You'll be noticing in the last few issues of DXAS that Fred has been adding a lot more news and notes, and we've all been sharing and reading these reports. This listener news is in keeping with many of the comments from the survey you've sent us, and we thank you so much for your input. After all, we can't exist in a vacuum. You folks are part of our team, and we're doing our part to bring you what you want and need, as long as you can do your part in telling us what you want. So keep the comments coming, and thanks sincerely for your kind and constructive input. Oh, and before I forget, apologies for the sudden cutoff of our report from Radio Canada last month. I'm not sure what happened, but you missed the last couple of minutes of that interference demonstration. The sudden disappearance of Radio Canada's report on the band scan might have been prophetic in light of the news that Radio Canada's international shortwave service is going away. There's been an awful lot of bad reaction to that news, but when you think about it, with as much value as such services provide, they are incredibly expensive to operate. Major costs, of course, are electricity for the transmitter and the staffing costs for the presenters. Taking a nod from the way the cable pukes value their systems on a per-viewer basis, the accountants estimate the number of listeners and divide that number into operating costs to derive a per-listener cost. And even with the most optimistic audience estimates, it just doesn't seem to make sense. So from a business perspective, I get it. From a service angle, however, it becomes much more of a subjective reaction, and there's been a lot of reaction. Typical of well-reasoned but emotional comment is this from Warren Kinsella of the QMI agency, and I quote, "The chipping away at Canada continues apace. Radio Canada International's shortwave service was, quite literally, Canada's voice to the world for nearly 70 years. Through wars, through triumphs and disasters, through it all, it has been part of our history. And now it's gone." The shortwave services started in 1942. Prime Minister Mackenzie King said it would help to keep our soldiers connected with what was going on back home. For our armed forces members in uniform then and now, RCI became an easy way to stay in touch with Canada and Canadians. Similarly, the service became a means by which we could subtly promote democracy and the Canadian way of life in far-flung corners of the world. In places like China, Russia, and North Korea, where the internet can be censored but shortwave can't be, RCI was heard by many. In post-communist Eastern Europe, shortwave radio receivers are still the way in which many receive news from the outside world. I know this from experience. When I was an election observer in Bosnia in 1996, billeted with a Serbian family, I was glued to my tiny shortwave radio at night. I'd listen to the Stanley Cup playoffs and the news from back home, and I was always pretty grateful that RCI existed. Our allies, the U.S., Britain, Germany, France, and Australia, have all expanded their national shortwave service. In Canada, meanwhile, we've killed it. The Harper regime, which has taken a chainsaw to the CBC in recent months, is ultimately to blame for this short-sighted decision. They will say that government needs to tighten its belt, and they're mostly right about that, but getting rid of RCI's shortwave service is penny-wise and pound-foolish. In all, keeping RCI on air would have cost about 35 cents a year per Canadian. In comparative terms, it's as much as it costs taxpayers to rent a couple of panda bears from China for zoos in Toronto and Calgary. Or it's a fifth of the cost of building gazebos in Tony Clement's riding and fake lakes for the G8G20 summit. Meanwhile, KPMG did a study on RCI and found it was the most efficient, that is, cost-effective, broadcaster of its type in the world. Why should you care? Does it matter? It matters. Billion-dollar fighter jets and super jails before a pittance for a radio station that promoted democracy and decency around the world? The idiots who came up with this outrageous decision should all be fired. Perhaps you didn't notice the death of RCI because you have access to lots of media here in Canada, or because you don't ever need to tune into shortwave radio. But to people around the world, to our men and women in uniform, the death of RCI won't go unnoticed. In small but undeniable ways, the Conservatives are chipping away at the very notion of what Canada was and what it is. Killing off RCI was thoughtless, it was ideological, and it was done without any appreciation of our history or our shared culture. In a very real way, the HarperCons are denuding us of the things that make us uniquely Canadian, to ourselves and to the world. That perspective was from Warren Kinsella of the QMI agency. You know, not so long ago, the shortwave bands brought us signals from every corner of the globe. Now, increasingly, all that's being left on the dial is strong local signals from American religious broadcasters. In defense of the planning of folks like the Voice of America and what was Radio Free Europe and Radio Liberty, they are going to local low-power FM stations in these countries, and they are being fed by satellite. So they've taken on the additional cost of satellite transmission, replacing shortwave, with the expectation of reaching eventually more and more people via local repeaters. The question is, how many local repeaters are there in darkest Africa? And on that note, we say so long for now. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. Hope Bridgeport is an enjoyable experience, and we look forward to the reports from the convention. Hope to share this spot with you once again in 30 days or so. Until then, good listening, DXers.
Radio Canada International. Radio Canada International. Radio Canada International. Radio Canada International.
Radio Silence. Canada signs off as an international broadcaster. By Garth Mullins. Across the Indian subcontinent and Asia, shortwave radio sets scan up and down familiar frequencies, seeking a signal from Canada that has come to be known as an old friend. Internet-blocked Chinese activists search the dial for Canadian news of a Hong Kong demonstration. But an ocean of low static is all that emanates from the Sackville, New Brunswick transmitter. Canada's once robust international radio voice has fallen silent, victim of the latest round of budget cuts. Recently, choked with emotion, Mark Montgomery closed out the final transmission of Radio Canada International after 67 years of shortwave programming to the world.
Well, now we have come to a point in the show. We only have a few minutes left in this final program, and I kind of find myself in the incredible position of being one of the last voices to be broadcast on Canada's international radio, and over these past few years it has been my extreme privilege to be able to work alongside some of the most dedicated and talented people I've ever known. But we're saying goodbye to teammates and colleagues, most of whom are reluctantly retiring or leaving the job they love to seek other employment, but every one of them with a strong sense of pride for a job extremely well done. I'm finding this very hard. For 67 years, RCI has been the country's voice to the world, broadcasting Canada's viewpoints and culture in several languages. Not without some rocky financial times, though. Over a decade ago, when our budget was about double what it is now, the accounting firm KPMG was hired to examine RCI, and they discovered to their surprise that, in comparison, it was probably the most efficient of international broadcasters. It currently costs Canadians about 34 cents a year for this international service. And I don't know about you, but personally, I have more loose change than that rattling around in the ashtray of my car.
Then, dead air. Radio stations shuttered and budgets slashed by 80%, RCI is now reduced to an anemic web presence and a skeleton staff. Like vinyl records, newspapers, and incandescent lights, the death of shortwave radio has long been heralded. But the global millions who listen regularly to RCI may disagree, and so do I. As a nearly blind child, my world was pretty small. But once I found shortwave radio, the world bloomed out of my orange foam headset. My dad slung a long wire up over a high branch in a neighbor's tree. That antenna connected me to something bigger, fracturing the lonely alienation of the 1980s. I pulled down signals from the other side of the world, hearing Latin American politics, Eastern Bloc propaganda, and the Voice of America warning, in simple English, of communism in our backyard. I heard critiques of Reaganomics and learned about the Squamish Five via the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, despite the Five living in the same city as me. Shortwave is how the last terrible moments of the Hungarian uprising of 1956 were communicated to the world. Revolutionaries pleading for help over the airwaves. Then Iron Curtain static as the radio station was overrun by Stalin's tanks. Radio has been an important part of every social movement in the 20th century. In the 1980s, El Salvador used an underground radio station and sometimes used barbed wire cut from cattle fences to transmit the signals. Unlike the internet, which is easily disrupted by dictators, hackers, wars, or natural disasters, shortwave cannot really be jammed and does not require the massive fiber optic networks, servers, and the miles of phone or cable lines. Unlike reading this story online, listening to radio does not leave an electronic record. A profile of one's interest cannot be generated by the authorities, though Canadians surely would never have cause to worry about this. I'm not a cyber Luddite. Podcasting has given birth to a radio renaissance and an explosion of voices. Just listen to Memory Palace, 99% Invisible, or Transom to see how the formats have been innovated. Yet, I would never want to see Vancouver's Co-op Radio or CBC Radio 1 reduced to an online-only presence. I want to live in a broad community, not a pod of one. Radio waves easily cross the digital divide. About a third of the world has no access to phones or electricity, never mind the internet. But battery-powered and hand-crank shortwave sets are ubiquitous all over the developing world, and they won't be hearing from Canada anymore. Shortwave is also a good backup when other forms of communications go down. It can be used to communicate internally in case of natural disasters. This was done during Hurricane Katrina, and it can even transmit internet content. Starting at the end of World War II, and eventually in 16 languages, RCI bounced the radio waves off the ionosphere and down to millions of listening ears. The service was beamed into the Eastern Bloc during the Cold War. People tuned in under authoritarian states in overseas markets in Asia and the Middle East, Eastern Europe and Africa. Signals outmaneuvered government sensors that now need only a couple of keystrokes to block that information. I'm not suggesting that RCI is a radical voice. It is no rabble or media co-op. But neither was the service of a mouthpiece for the Canadian government. It did have to consult periodically with the Department of Foreign Affairs and International Trade about where to broadcast, but it had editorial freedom, regularly covered social movements, strikes, and ingenuous issues. Of 18 Western countries, Canada is 16th in terms of expenditure per capita on public broadcasting, narrowly beating out New Zealand and the United States, but RCI punched above its weight. Please, Canada, find a way to avoid severing your own tongue. The world is listening to you, pleads U.S. citizens and founding director of the U.S. NGO EARS, to Our World, Thomas Witherspoon. In the 80s, 20 million Chinese listened to English from a series of RCI broadcasts running for months in advance of regular programming to the Middle Kingdom. But China is now more of a market for Canadian petrol than radio. Last weekend, Hong Kong erupted into pro-democracy protests, but on the Chinese mainland, the state was able to censor most reporting by blocking the internet content through deep packet analysis or simply by flooding the propaganda from government bloggers and tweeters. Previously, millions turned to RCI's Voice of Canada and would have heard such news, but RCI's website is blocked by China. International shortwave is old school for sure. At fractions of a cent per listener, it's also cheap and accessible. It allows activists overseas to hear what their own governments are up to. Radio is part of the global conversation. The RCI Action Committee is an employee effort with union support campaigning to save the service. And that article was by Garth Mullins, who is a writer and a longtime social justice activist and three-chord propagandist living in East Vancouver. You can follow him at Garth Mullins, GARTHMULLINS, on Twitter.
For all of us, thank you so much, and goodbye.
Well done, Mark.
And such was the demise of RCI. But the story doesn't stop there, because another shortwave station is calling it quits. Tom Witherspoon will be with us on Side 2 of this magazine with the story of Radio Netherlands. But right now, please flip your tape over to side two.
Broadcasting from the International Tower in Long Beach, this is KFOX and KFOX-FM, Los Angeles.
Can you really rock and roll, Billy Boy, Billy Boy? Can you really rock and roll, charming Billy? I can really rock and roll, I can even do the stroll. But I'm a young man and I can't leave my mother. Can you play your guitar, Billy Boy, Billy Boy?